Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Aaron Greenwald about the exhibit and the book, New Orleans, the Founding Era. We'll also hear from poets Brett Evans and Christopher Shipman about their new book, Keats is Not the Problem. Greenwald is the curator of programs at the New Orleans Museum of Art. She's the author of A Company Man, the remarkable French Atlantic voyage of a clerk for the Company of the Indies, and The Company of the Indies in Louisiana, Trade in the French Atlantic World. Today we're talking about New Orleans, the Founding Era, the beautiful companion volume to the exhibit she curated at the historic New Orleans collection, now on view. Aaron Greenwald, it's so good to have a new book from you. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
This began as a tricentennial project, and describe the things you're looking for when you curate an exhibit like this. It seems like it's wrangling a lot of different things.
It absolutely is. When we started putting together this exhibition at the Historic New Orleans Collection, it was important for me as a curator to complicate the idea of the tricentennial as a purely celebratory event. Mm-hmm. I think it's an important time for us to reflect on the last 300 years, which have often been messy. And at no point was New Orleans' history messier, I think, than the first 50 years of its existence. And so when we're looking to put things together, it was important that we bring together objects that speak to a diversity of experiences for people living and working in New Orleans during the founding era.
And you've put together such a variety of topics, all with matching scholars, too. So tell us some of the topics.
That's right. So for the companion volume to New Orleans, the Founding Era, we've brought together 9 essays from 8 scholars living both here in the United States and abroad in France. And they have tackled questions of free migration, forced migration, whether it was enslaved Africans coming from West Central Africa, or soldiers, you know, a group of people we don't often think about, I don't think, as being a foundational group for the early colony. When New Orleans was founded, the labor for clearing the site was provided largely not by enslaved Africans because they hadn't quite arrived yet, but by soldiers, people who had been impressed, indentured servants, and enslaved Native Americans, primarily Chitimacha Indians.
Well, that's one of the interesting chapters for me. This essay by Robbie Etheridge, The Native World Before New Orleans. And it just conjures this lost world. And it's matched with pre-Columbian pottery, jewelry, really striking artifacts. So that's something that I think a lot of people will find really interesting.
We wanted to put together a picture of what the Lower Mississippi Valley, which wasn't even called the Lower Mississippi Valley,
right. Looked
like before New Orleans and really before Hernando de Soto's expedition in the first half of the 16th century. It was important for us to recognize that though New Orleans was founded in 1718 as the settlement of New Orleans, there were societies and groups of people who predated the French colonization of this area, many of whom still have members of their populations among us today.
One of the things that fascinates me about putting something together like this is that it seems to me that these scholars are using the artifacts and the art as a muse, that they're writing toward that object or painting that they're talking about. One of the essays that really struck me in that regard was Emily Clark's essay, Missionary Orders in French Colonial New Orleans. And she's writing about this gorgeous engraving and watercolor, Catholic Religious in America, and architectural plans for the Ursuline Convent.
It's a show of great scholarly inspiration.
The fact that many of the writers in this volume are speaking to objects is intentional. We really wanted to further contextualize important material culture objects in addition to maps and plans and watercolors. Emily's essay is an excellent example of a scholar who is using these artifacts, these 300-year-old artifacts or 200-year-old artifacts, to illuminate for a modern-day audience what it was like to be involved in a massive colonization project. For the Catholic Church, they had a significant presence here in Louisiana. But in New Orleans, their presence was really not as strong as you might think in terms of the male Catholic orders. The world of New Orleans' religious life is greatly shaped by the Ursuline nuns mm-hmm. and their influence in preparing individuals for baptism, whether they're free or enslaved, their role in running the hospital, something they were quite reluctant to do, but ended up taking a role in doing, they were really formative to people's experiences here in New Orleans in the founding era.
And I love that they were such stubborn women. You know, they're like, the churches, you need to be out there converting people. And they're like, well, you know, we don't have a convent yet. You were supposed to build us a convent.
Right. They really wanted to come to the New World to carry out their educational mission. Yes. But the way they were able to come here, in fact, was the colony was in desperate need of a group of sisters to run the hospital. And the Company of the Indies, which was then the managing organization of the colony, did not have success in bringing in some of the more traditional nursing orders. So the Ursulines agreed to come here. They arrive in 1727, but they then say, well, as part of the agreement, you have to build us a convent, and we won't begin administering to the hospital population and taking care of the hospital until that convent is complete. So it's not actually until 1734 that the Ursuline's first convent is completed. And in that interim between 1727 and 1734, they really are able to establish a very strong foothold as leaders within the population for educating.
Well, the other thing about that, too, that you appreciate anew when you look at something like this is, well, a couple of things. The Catholic Church as a records keeper, that they do have these treasures. And the durability of paper.
Right. It is striking, especially in our climate and in our environment, that the Archdiocese of New Orleans has truly been able to maintain and keep, if not originals, because of some of the fires in the late 18th century, copies of the originals that date to the 18th century. And they are an incredibly important resource. Without those records, we wouldn't know, for example, that in the early 1730s, 66% of all individuals baptized at the St. Louis Church were Africans or people of African descent. And that's largely a factor of the Code Noir requiring that all enslaved Africans be baptized. But still, without that paper, we would not understand the magnitude of their role.
Mm-hmm. And you have a copy of the Code Noir in the exhibit as well.
Yes.
So it's kind of amazing to look at that, don't you think?
It is amazing. It's a document that has had a larger-than-life presence in both reality and in the imagination of many New Orleanians and many Louisianans in the present day. Sometimes that's a document that is referenced in the present day as making somehow slavery under the French more manageable, more livable. But when you really study the Code Noir, that is in fact not true. This is a document that reinforces a hereditary, racialized slavery that exists throughout the Americas.
Wow. Now, another essay that struck me was Yeventarian's essay, Forced European Migrants and Soldiers in French Colonial New Orleans. And this essay reminds us that not everybody wanted to be here.
No, in fact, I think the majority of the population did not arrive voluntarily. If you look at the population of Africans who arrived in New Orleans, you're looking at a little less than 50% of the population in the early 1720s being of African descent. But then you're also looking at one quarter of the white population being brought here as soldiers. And soldiers were terribly paid, terribly fed, and often didn't have a choice in coming. There was still a lot of impressment that was happening in France. And then you have others who are literally rounded up from France, from the streets, some of whom their only offense is being poor or being unemployed, and sent to Louisiana to labor and essentially improve the quality of life for people living in France.
Shocking. I mean, shocking, shocking. Now, MacArthur winner Shannon Lee Dottie has an essay in this as well, Archaeology of Everyday Life in Early New Orleans. And that's just fascinating. I mean, even now when we see roadwork, an exceptionally deep pothole, we conjure the land that's shifting beneath us. So her essay really drew me.
Archaeology is a critical component in this exhibition, New Orleans, the Founding Era. And Shannon Dottie is truly an inspiration in helping historians, I think, reimagine the work that they do. Historians are trained primarily to rely on the written record. But what that means is you're often dealing with a fragmented documentary record that is made worse by the fact that written records often are not produced by large segments of the population. People who are illiterate, people who are poor, people who are enslaved. It's very difficult to get a good understanding of life for everyone in a settlement like New Orleans without turning to material culture. And archaeology helps us do that. You know, we've been able to, through archaeological excavations and research, have a far better understanding of the colonial diet. One of the objects on view in the exhibition is actually a persimmon seed, because we're trying to understand, what are people eating? And are those foodstuffs local? And in the case of the persimmon, it was. Or are they being brought here from Africa or from Europe? What are people eating, and how does that shape their experiences?
So I'm often curious about historians, especially here you are. You're putting together this exhibit. You're drawing from all different parts of the culture. What is it you mentally imagine? What is it you would most like to see, if you could see? If you could time travel back to the founding era and see anything in this exhibit in its natural setting, what would it be?
What would it be? I think it would be a better understanding, a better visual picture of just how important waterways were to life in the colony. New Orleans is situated on a site that is prone to flooding. Mm-hmm. And that means it's also prone to higher levels of disease and unsanitary conditions, but it's located where it is because of the confluence of the Mississippi River and Bayou St. John and Lake Pontchartrain. And I think if I could go back, I would want to be on the water and understand the role that the rivers and the bayous and the lakes played then, that we are in many ways disconnected from now, even though we are still one of the most powerful ports in the world. The levee is at this point so built up that we are in many ways, as New Orleanians, disconnected from the river in a way that 18th century Louisianans would not have been.
Well, sometimes when I read a really good novel, I go around for a few days, and that's the lens through which I see the city, if it's really, really good. And has this made you see things in that way?
Sure. I mean, I see where I live in Gentilly right now as a wilderness. I wonder about its early residents, people like Louis Congo, who was a freed African who served as the colony's executioner, and the Drew brothers, who operated a plantation and a brewery here. So when I go around town, I absolutely wonder about the people who lived here before me, many, many years before me.
I even wonder about the people who lived in my house. I mean, you know, that goes back a ways sometimes. We've been talking with Erin Greenwald about New Orleans, the Founding Era, the gorgeous companion volume to the fascinating exhibit, now on view at the Historic New Orleans Collection until May 27th. Erin, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Thank you. Evans and Chris Shipman are teachers and poets and poetic collaborators. We last spoke with them about their wonderful work, T-Rex Parade, and now they're back with a new collaborative collection called Keats Is Not the Problem. April is Poetry Month, so it's a good time to check in with them, and they'll be at the New Orleans Poetry Festival today as well. Brett, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be back.
You too, Chris.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You two say you've been having this poetic conversation since you met at a reading in Vicksburg. So what was it that drew you two together, Chris? Shared sensibility, that shared sense of humor?
Well, when we met in Vicksburg, I was actually living in Baton Rouge at the time. And, you know, I think for both of us, having the reading in Vicksburg was a little strange. And, you know, as Brett said, we're kind of out of our element. And I think that we kind of drew together even more because of that. I think we were both kind of riffing off of each other, and our styles are, they're different, but, you know, when we ended up working together for the first time, I think that we found, like, there is a voice that we could find that we had recently decided is Chet, the third voice. But yeah, it just works. I've collaborated with a lot of people. Working with Brett has always been just fun.
This book is such a New Orleans book. You all are having such a conversation about the city and all the things that are happening these days. So what is that process of collaborating? You know, I think of Jack Bedell and Daryl Bork doing that call and response book. How do you exchange poems? How do you determine the course of the book, its final form?
For me, that's one of the things that I really like about working with Brett is that there's very little of that conversation actually happening. Mm-hmm. It's just the work sort of takes care of itself. We don't talk too much in between about the poems. We just send each other work. And then if Brett sends me something, then I'll read it and sort of take some sort of inspiration for that and write a, not necessarily a direct response that addresses that poem directly. Sometimes it does in a sort of indirect way. The things that that you're bringing up in the book that have to do with New Orleans that just sort of happen naturally.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're both, I've been here for 6 years now. He's been here forever, of course, off and on. And I think that being in a place like New Orleans and being a poet, New Orleans is going to be in your work.
Right.
I think that's just a very natural thing that happened.
Well, I've had this book lying on my desk and my coffee table for a while now. And everybody walks by and picks it up and goes, well, if Keats is not the problem, what is?
I know, right?
Just what is?
Well, should it, do we say the origin of the title? Or?
Yeah,
well,
go for
yes.
it.
Spoiler alert. We realized we both had Roger Kamenetz as a shared teacher.
Ah.
But I had him in my very first college creative writing class. And then Chris had him in graduate school.
My very first class in grad school.
But this is like 25 years apart or something. I don't want to do the math exactly, but
yeah.
there was some time, that a lot of time between those two events. But we both had Roger as a teacher, and that was just great. Roger, one night I was at his house a few years ago, and I guess he was basically doing or thinking about moving from his house to a smaller spot in the city. And he was talking about downsizing your book collection and how difficult that is. And I said to him, well, you know, sometimes you just want to take Keats back off the shelf and reread it. And he just looked at me and said, Brett, Keats is not the problem.
Oh, that is a wonderful
spoiler
alert.
But now he swears that I said it to him. It doesn't really make sense, unless I was just doing both parts. But
right.
No, he definitely said that. So it was hilarious.
Oh, so why don't you read the title poem for us, Chris?
Sure. Keats is not the problem. It's not the tag on the t-shirt shot from the cannon, but I wanted to say thanks, Custom Ink, and have it on Brett's doorstep before Brett could canonize the masses meaningful, without them knowing anything ever happened. I'm feeling the right costume, cape, and smile could really move the books off the shelf. But then again, the TV poet on Transparent just said lostness, and everyone applauded. Maybe my gifts are best given in another world, where we ain't afraid of no ghosts, where Brett tells a moving story, maybe the one we've all heard, maybe the one we've all told, maybe the one with the books and not all of them can go, the one when the move from uptown to tracks really gets clacking, the one when every time Brett says to Kamenetz, or maybe Kamenetz to Brett, Keats is not the problem, something meaningful happens.
Oh, I love that even more now because I'm downsizing my book. So it makes perfect sense to me in so many ways. Now, Brett, a lot of your poems, or two of my favorite of your poems, have to do with New Orleans wildlife, as
right.
it were. And you have a poem with a roach giant that struck close to home for me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the one of all the currents of the city of the last, you know, whatever, 10, 20 years, everything that's been changing and evolving and degrading. One thing that's a constant is our our roach friends, right? Like that's, I could have written this one in the 70s, and I don't think it would have been much different.
Yes, you could have written this in my house last weekend.
Right, or definitely. The 70s or yesterday, and probably the year 2040, when the roaches were on the sewage and water board instead of the powers that be. Roach giant. And after I just see the, are you kidding me, sized cockroach, somehow not fleeing the scything foot, then I see why. He's a roach with a fuzzbar sidecar. Got a fuzzball sidecar tag-along, anchor weight in nano ounces, yet enough to lame him as he weeges to the corner behind clawfoot tub. And I'm suddenly sympathetic. I too have started mornings with kites made of lead flying off foot, pushing a big lint racket up the mountain, blowing my own levee, ruining for the hills. I go into the next room and write these lines down. He appears again as I return to the bathroom, and just after I'd written the previous sympathy bit, he now flagrantly forces the kill. I return with paper towel, but when going in for said kill, he goes belly up and does the ill pickle leg wiggle thing. So half against my will again, with the towel, I perform a fuzzballectomy. Just last week, I lost a dog and send him on his way.
So both of you are teachers. How do your students respond to your work, or do you share it with them in the classroom?
I actually don't generally share my work with my students. Sometimes I do in creative writing. Mm-hmm. If I'm teaching something or we're talking about some sort of exercise and you know, a poem that I've written makes a lot of sense for me to introduce to them, or if they ask me enough, then I'll eventually break down and read them something. Around Halloween, I read them some things that I might have written. I have a book called The Movie My Murderer Makes, and that's, you know, some spooky prose poems. So, that's fun to read for them, and they really respond. But actually, I have a colleague at St. Martin's where I teach. His name's Al Tritico, and he shows up in this book. And he often does teach my work to the freshmen. So when they come to me as sophomores, they come asking, can you read me some work? Or like, are we going to read your work? And I'm just like, no, I can't. We can't.
That's pretty good.
So yeah. How do you feel about the young poets out there, the ones you are teaching?
Oh, they're great. You know, we are going to be at the Poetry Fest. My creative writing students are going to be at the upcoming Poetry Fest on the 22nd, that Sunday, with a mobile idea lab that my creative writing students have affectionately renamed Mr. E Machine. And I think, you know, as a joke, but also they don't really understand what it is. Has a stage that comes out of it, a TV, all sorts of weird compartments. So we're going to be using that sort of odd space to do all sorts of creative writing exercises with participants, or really anyone off the street who wants to participate. I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun. They're really eager about that. And they're hungry. That's what I would say. You know, it's really pleasing to be around so many young writers who, because I have, I think, 15 students in my creative writing class right
wow.
now. And the entire sophomore class is only 50 students or around there. So to have a class that is that big, that's an elective, tells me that, you know, they're really interested in mm-hmm. expressing themselves in that way, which is great.
What about your students, Brett?
As far as poetry?
Yeah.
I guess it's not like I wouldn't do it, but I usually wouldn't just read my poems directly. I think a lot of times I do things like my friend Frank Sherlock, a Philadelphia poet that I've also done work with in the past, ended up becoming the Poet Laureate of Philadelphia, and he has this great inaugural poem where he's reading in with, you know, with the mayor of Philadelphia right to his side. And it's just a cool poem, and I'll play that and be like, okay, well, that's my friend, and, you know, it make it seem like it's just a few degrees removed between me and greatness.
Well, you are the I thought you were the poet laureate of gentility.
I am now, yeah.
I mean, I
was the poet laureate of Domain Street, which, well, we can talk about the rest of that off mic, but it was some usurping involved. But, I'll be the poet laureate of gentility.
I think that's a very fine thing to be.
That's cool.
Chris, you'll just have to stake out your own neighborhood.
Yeah, well, he gets to take the old neighborhood now.
Okay.
I'm down there in Mid-City.
Okay.
The Harry House.
Well, we've been talking with Brad Evans and Chris Shipman about their new book, Keats Is Not the Problem. You can meet them Sunday at the New Orleans Poetry Festival. Brett, Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much. Great.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Sunday, April 22nd, is the final day of the New Orleans Poetry Festival and Small Press Book Fair at the New Orleans Healing Center. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, April 23rd at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Come and network and bring a book to exchange. Poet Mary Emma Dutra Pearson reads from her book, New Orleans, City of My Heart, Monday, April 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Raynard Sanders discusses and signs the book, 21st Century Jim Crow Schools, The Impact of Charters on Public Education, Tuesday, April 24th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Historian Winston Ho discusses Chinese American history in New Orleans, Shrimp Drying, Wednesday, April 25th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Three local authors, Mary Gaiman, author of Cardi the Cardinal Finds a Home in Donaldsonville, Mary Beth McGee, author of Grandpa's Mustache, and Karen Walston, author of The Adventures of Chico and Walter, discuss their new children's books Thursday, April 26th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Jane Austen Literary Festival takes place Saturday, April 28th from 9:30 to 5 at the Jean-Baptiste Lang House. That's at 605 Carroll Street in Mandeville. The event includes dancing lessons, entertainment, a grand march and promenade, and going for the world record of the most people dressed in Regency attire in St. Tammany Parish. There's a No Plain Jane's fashion show and a Mr. Darcy oratory contest, and there will be a Richard Boyd poetry panel and more. Check out JaneAustenFestival.org for ticket information. And here at The Reading Life, we're celebrating New Orleans' tricentennial by putting together a list of 300 great books about New Orleans. Send us your favorites to LABooks at WWNO.org and see if they make the list. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.